First, I'm Nancy Smith. I'm the moderator. I hope we will have a lively panel today. We have some excellent panelists. Some have been on the town hall before, and others are brand new and new topics. So I'm going to quickly list their names and have them wave, and then we'll go through and each one can tell you briefly what their office does, what they're trying to do with their program, and then if there are hot topics that might want to be discussed. I know I've already heard about several hot topics, including, John, this is probably for you, the new oncology initiative that was announced yesterday, I believe. We want to summarize the key issues and identify the hot topics. So we have down near the other end, Leah Crystal, who is our associate director for biosimilars. And if you have questions about biosimilars, she's the one to go. We have Gerald Delpan, who has been in this panel for many times from surveillance and epidemiology. We have John Jenkins, who is from the Office of New Drugs. He was just talking in the previous session. He also has been in town halls for as long as I've been involved with them. Then we have Michael Kopcha, who is new to CDER. I think he's only been there about 4 months. So he will bring new perspective. He's the Office of Pharmaceutical Quality. We have Teresa Mullen, who has been on our panel before. She is the Office of Strategic Programs. And then we have Lynn Yao, who is the Director of Pediatric and Maternal Health, and she's new. After they do their introductions, there will be two ways you can ask questions. You can write them on a card. This is your session. We have no pre-planned agenda. So you can write it on a card or you can go to the mic. Now, if you definitely want to get your question answered, if it matters, then you probably want to go to a mic. Because if this is anything like previous town hall meetings that we've had, we will have many, many more cards than we will possibly be able to get to. And I will try to pick the most pertinent ones or the areas we've had the least discussion of so far. But I would now like to start with Teresa and let her tell us about her office and briefly what hot topics she thinks, or what she thinks are hot topics.
Okay, good morning. We've established, I'm Teresa Mullen. I direct the Office of Strategic Programs. And the Office of Strategic Programs, OSP, basically tries to help the center modernize and plan for its future. And so the major functions in our office include business informatics, developing data standards, leading patient-focused drug development, and doing evaluations and planning of different programs within the organization, and leaning out processes. That's another component that we do. And earlier, Nancy asked me to mention what the hot topics were for our office recently. And I also, our office leads the international program, as the international program for the Center for Drugs. So I'd have to say over the past year, probably our hottest areas have been the maturing of the data standards effort. If you got your DIA brochure, you might have seen a page in there that's sort of an advertisement or almost a warning about the coming ECTD submission requirements. So that's one of the things that's important. We have helped with the modernization and the reforms of ICH, and so that's been something that's happened and will continue to mature and will help with over the coming year. The Prescription Drug User Fee Act reauthorization negotiations had gone on in the past year and will continue to work for timely reauthorization of that program. The biosimilar user fee programs, we've led those negotiations, and those are moving along well and moving on to their next step. And the patient-focused drug development program is one we've been leading on behalf of the center, and we're ready to and poised to finish the commitments of the current PDUFA program and help with whatever will come next and the commitments we've made for the future.
Thank you. Gerald?
So good morning. I'm Gerald Dalpin. I'm the director of the Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology. We have four broad functions. First, we review all the adverse event reports that we receive, and we received about 1.5 million adverse event reports last year. and that number continues to grow every year. We're also responsible for pharmacoepidemiology in the center, and the big initiative in the past year has been integrating Sentinel into the review process. Sentinel was the mini Sentinel, a pilot program, and now it's been transferred to us in the last year and a half, and so as it becomes fully stood up and operational, we're spending a lot of time integrating it into the review process. We also have a division of medication error prevention and analysis. They're probably most well known for reviewing proposed proprietary names. They also look at carton and container label and human factor studies. And then we have a division of risk management that reviews all the REMS, and we've put on some advisory committees about those. Everything we do is done in collaboration with Office of New Drugs, Office of Generic Drugs, Pediatric Maternal Health Staff, OPQ, and many other offices.
Lynn?
Good morning, everybody. My name's Lynn Yao, and I'm the Director of the Division of Pediatrics and Maternal Health in the Office of New Drugs. Our group helps to promote and protect the public health of women, pregnant women, children, and women who are lactating. We help the centers review the data related to pediatric product development, use of drugs during pregnancy and lactation. We help to implement the provisions under pre-MBPCA that govern pediatric product development. We're also involved in the implementation of the pregnancy lactation labeling rule.
Thank you. John?
Again, I'm John Jenkins. I'm the director of the Office of New Drugs, and we're responsible for essentially the full life cycle of new drugs, investigational oversight for safety of human subjects through marketing application review to post-marketing surveillance, working in collaboration with Gerald's office, new indications post-marketing. We also are the office responsible for review of biosimilars. We oversee over-the-counter products, so it's a very broad remit across many therapeutic areas. It's hard to identify what I would say are a short list of hot topics because we have so many hot topics. Many of the ones you've already heard of hot topics from Teresa, Gerald, and Lynn would be hot topics for my office as well. So I'm not going to try to give a short list because it's a very long list of hot topics.
Okay, Leah.
My name is Leah Crystal. I am the Associate Director for Therapeutic Biologics in the Office of New Drugs, and I lead the Therapeutic Biologics and Biosimilars staff in OND. We facilitate the biosimilar review program across CDER. Even though we sit in OND, we do facilitate a program all across CDER. We are also engaged in supporting the Office of New Drugs with regard to therapeutic biological products, overlapping issues with regard to the development and approval of those products now that we have biosimilar and interchangeable programs ongoing. I don't think I need to identify hot topics beyond saying I do biosimilars. sort of a hot topic in and of itself. So I'm certainly happy to be here and answer questions as I can.
And Michael?
My name is Mike Kopcha. I head up, or I'm the director for the Office of Pharmaceutical Quality. As Nancy had pointed out, I've only been with the FDA now for about 7.5 months. So the private sector, I was in the private sector for over 25 years. The public sector now is new, is something that's new for me. The Office of Pharmaceutical Quality, as the name implies, is responsible for ensuring the quality of drugs that are currently on the market, as well as the quality of drugs that are going through the approval process. The office itself is responsible for doing the review of generic drugs, new drugs, as well as biotech products. That's part of what we do. We also have an office which is responsible for doing process and facility inspections. Surveillance inspections is also part of what we do. And we have a policy group that helps define the policy around quality. This group was stood up about a year and a half ago, and the reason for that was to focus all of the quality work within one office within the CDER Center. So that's kind of an overview of who and what we are.
Thank you. Now, we've heard of wonderful things that are going on at CDER, and a lot of programs that everyone's probably heard of, and perhaps some that you weren't aware. So I hope you have a lot of questions. If we don't have questions, excuse me, this will be a short session. if you have a question, you can write it on a card or on a paper. Patrick, who is sitting here at the front, is going to try to coordinate getting them to me as they come. So, who would like to be the first person coming to a microphone? This is always the toughest part. Oh, I think we have a brave soul. Oh, a couple of brave souls.
I'll try this again. I tried it in the last session. But
okay, name and...
Yes. Name is Greg Gogate, CRF Health. And now that the FDA is going to be accepting e-source data from certified EHR systems, as this draft guidance came out, they say that a certified EHR is an acceptable source of e-source. Will you be considering allowing the eCOA vendors and some of the vendors that are also collecting eSource on the research side of the business to certify themselves, and this would their data collection systems, because it's essentially the same thing. So this will alleviate the redundant vendor qualification audits that we now endure throughout the industry, because all of our customers expect us to be validated, have validated systems, and they feel obligated to come and verify that. So if we were certified, as is now being allowed or will be allowed by the EHR vendors, that would alleviate a lot of the burden on both sides of the house. So it would save time and resources on the exercise that is seen as a regulatory expectation to be done by each of our customers. So I don't know if the quality group maybe can talk to that. It seems like this would be a good thing moving forward to stop some redundant audits that happen out there in the industry.
Mike, would you like to comment?
Sure. Our intent is to obviously try to reduce regulatory oversight going forward, hence the reason why we're looking at putting quality metrics in place and being able to have a way to do surveillance throughout the industry so that we have a better feel for the state of affairs, if you will, for the companies that we're responsible for overseeing. There's some 5,000 that we're responsible for. As we begin to search our databases, mine those databases, and clean up those databases, that information then will come to us to help us make those assessments as we go from company to company in terms of looking at their state of quality. So depending upon the risk that's associated with a given company, will determine, hopefully, the frequency that we would go in there and then audit those companies. That would include not only the manufacturing pieces, but also any databases, repositories that the company would be responsible for in support. One, the applications, these would be during pre-approval inspections, and then secondly, during routine surveillance inspections, which would be typically during your GMP. So I'm not 100% familiar with some of the database, or the database that you were referring to, so I'm not quite sure if I was able to answer that question directly.
This is really before, this is like not the inspection side, but this is the expectation of the industry that any vendor that's used by a sponsor has the appropriate controls in place, Part 11 validation,
right,
the whole nine yards. So it's not necessarily under the direct regulatory purview, it's indirect, because you will verify that they have done and looked at us.
Right.
And because right now you're saying the ECOAS, the EHR systems can be certified, and that's under a NIST-NAVLAP program. So it would really be nice if we could expand that program into the research industry and say that a vendor system, if certified through the NIST-NAVLAP program, is acceptable by the agency. Therefore, you're not required as a sponsor to go individually audit your vendors every single time. And
right.
And I can speak to all the vendors here. We get audited every month, twice a month. It's crazy.
I think the answer on this panel is the same as the answer on the previous panel. I don't think the right people to answer that question are here.
Okay.
Oh, well,
thank
I tried
you for
again.
The question anyway.
I tried again. But everybody understands the issue. Mm-hmm.
Ranjita Sanval, we have two safety-related questions and a regulatory-related third question. So I want to start off with the IND reporting rule and the concept of safety assessment committee. The guidance is fairly high level at this time. I think there are some common elements as to there's a concept of anticipated events, there's a concept of benchmarking, what your background rates are, there's a concept of threshold setting, there's a concept of this unblinded safety assessment committee, which is meeting more frequently than the DMC. However, when you start thinking about how do you operationalize it, how do you define what the anticipated events are, there are certain common themes based upon the disease indication area. However, when you put three scientists or physicians in a room, they would, they might rank those anticipated events differently as to what they expect in this underlying population or the demographics of the population as such. So in order to harmonize some of these elements so that the industry as a whole can approach it in a more unified, harmonized manner. Are there any plans of setting up workshops and, you know, involving sponsors of different sizes, therapeutic areas, to see how can the best practices and how kind of fine tune the guidance and guide the industry better?
Okay, let's try to keep our questions as short as we can. But thank you. Gerald, do you want to?
I think that if it's the IND safety reporting role,
okay.
Do you want to?
I don't know of any plans for workshops or what you're describing at this point, so no, I'm not aware of any.
Let's take a question over here, and then you can do another one.
Good morning. Delana Brockwell from Grunenthal, USA. My question is on breakthrough therapy designation. The map says that for once a product's designated, the initial meeting should be held 60 days to 6 months. Within that, depending upon where the product is in development, is there a standard way to for companies to know how soon that will be, especially for non-oncology products, so that you can prepare to start your briefing book and have everything ready?
The meeting you're referring to is a comprehensive development overview meeting that we recommend the company request. So in many ways, it's driven by when you request the meeting, because we have goal dates for when we schedule and hold meetings depending upon the type. So there's a time frame in there because you may need more time or less time to prepare a background package for that comprehensive meeting. So a lot of the time frame is dependent upon the sponsor for when you think you're ready to request that meeting, to have a useful background package that you can submit questions that you want to ask the agency to address. So again, much of that range is driven by the sponsor when you think you're ready to come in for that meeting.
Great, thank you.
Okay, you have another one?
Yeah, so the regulatory question, which by the way was requested by a colleague who had to leave due to flight constraints, is kind of a tag on to the BTT question, and her experience was that the BTT designation council had requested a two-page summary document. However, this was accepted by OHAP, but not by the CBER bacterial division. So any guidance on that, on the BTT summary, two-page document?
It was not accepted by whom?
The CBER bacterial division.
Oh. I don't control CBER, so.
This is the CDER town hall. So that question would be more appropriate. There was a CBER town hall earlier.
Okay.
That would have been a more appropriate time.
I'm not specifically sure what you're asking about. Are you asking about kind of the preliminary advice stage where we've allowed companies the opportunity to submit a very brief background information, to have preliminary advice from the sponsor, from the agency on whether we think a breakthrough therapy designation request is appropriate?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, I think that's a CDER program. I don't know if it's a CBER program or not. So I can't address your specific issue. And one of the things that we suggested in the previous section is not to bring product-specific issues, but more general issues, because we're not going to be able to address product-specific issues in this forum.
Thank you. And this is a question for Dr. Dalpan. The use of metasentinel, is that something you're considering leveraging for IND submissions as well as for PMR requirements?
So Sentinel at this point is something that FDA is using. It hasn't been opened up to the public yet, and we're hoping it becomes a national resource. And there is work through IMEDS that some companies are trying to access Sentinel that way, and I think they've had some success there. At this point, we are using Sentinel for post-market safety questions. I think there's broader interest in how systems like Sentinel could be used in drug development, but that's more in an exploratory stage. Our use of Sentinel now is really for our ability to look into safety signals.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question over here.
Hi, I'm Beth Sporney from Cumberland Pharmaceuticals. I hope I have a brief question. Any PDUFA updates? Haven't seen it mentioned during this DIA session.
Teresa, is that for you?
Which PDUFA would you like to hear about? PDUFA? The PDUFAs to come? So basically,
the current authorization expires in September of 2017. And so to complete the process that's laid out in statute for the reauthorization, and there's a fairly extensive process that we need to follow. We had begun that process about this time last year. We had a public meeting in July of 2015 to sort of kick it off. We had negotiations with regulated industry that ran from September through early winter, through early 2016. And we're at the point where the package of proposed recommendations that FDA and industry tentatively agreed to is undergoing administration review. So the administration has to review it and clear it. And when that process is completed, and we really are hopeful that will happen very soon, then we can proceed to publish a Federal Register notice, make public what the proposed commitments would be, as you know the statute directs us to do, and have a public meeting to get further input. The process that we undergo, we take with PDUFA, and again per statute requires, and what we've done is meet monthly with other public stakeholders during the time that negotiations have been ongoing with industry. And so there's probably a pretty good familiarity among those people, and also those who follow the meeting minutes that are posted on our website about the kinds of things that have been discussed. But we'll be able to share those more publicly when we finish the clearance process. And so we're anticipating that in the next few months we'll be able to have that public meeting and get the public comments and complete that process for the PDUFA program. And hopefully that'll support a timely reauthorization.
Anything you can leak out now?
I'm afraid not.
Okay.
But stay tuned, and maybe you'll make it to the public meeting, and then you can make it. And you know, and
next
I'm sure
year at this time, she ought to be able to leak.
Patricia, what did I leak, Nancy? I don't think I leaked anything.
Leak information.
Patricia, there is publicly available information about what was discussed from the meeting minutes, from the sessions we had with industry.
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
Those are on the website.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's not leaking. That's public. That's transparency. So,
public knowledge. Okay, next question.
Sarah Nocher from Alnylam Pharmaceuticals in Cambridge. This follows up on the previous session where we were talking about breakthrough designation. And Dr. Jenkins, you mentioned that the Medical Policy Council does review them. However, we just talked about the two-pager that goes to the division. Would you care to comment on, you know, potentially the division, you know, having a different opinion and it not really reaching to the medical council, many of the requests? I understand the reason, especially given the numbers of designation requests you're getting, but I'm wondering whether there might be differences based on which division it goes to as opposed to one body reviewing it.
Well, there are two separate things that you've mixed into that question. The two-pager is a preliminary feedback from the division about whether they think that a breakthrough therapy designation request submission is appropriate at that time. That's purely advisory. It has no regulatory roadblock to you submitting a request for breakthrough therapy designation. We did that because companies were asking for that type of early advisory. Those are not reviewed by the Medical Policy Council. The Medical Policy Council reviews the actual designation request and hears from the review division their recommendation on whether the request should be granted or denied. So there's no plan for the Medical Policy Council to review that early communication because it's not binding. It's not a regulatory action. It's simply a brief conversation to say, yeah, we think you're in the ballpark, or no, we don't think you're in the ballpark, but it has no binding authority, so no, we don't plan to review those.
Understood. So basically the sponsor is then free to go ahead and submit to the policy council.
Yes, and we debated internally whether we even wanted to offer that preliminary advice situation because some might view it as a conflict of interest for the division to give that advice and say, oh no, we don't think you should submit the request. We decided to go ahead and have that preliminary opportunity available, but we make very clear that it's simple advice, it's not binding, and companies are free to submit the request independent of what advice they got from the division.
Thank you.
I would encourage you, if you want to write down, if you're bashful about going to the microphone, you may write your question on a card and just pass it to the end of the aisle, and Patrick's ready to get them if need be.
Hi, Melissa Tice from Merck. This is for Leah, Crystal. What is the FDA?
I'm sorry, can you speak more directly?
So it's Melissa Tice from Merck. What is the FDA's biosimilar guidance for the four-letter suffix to be added to the INN? How many recommendations are you looking for? And how does the FDA review these recommendations to make a decision? We do with the medical policy with our naming of our drugs, but what do you do with these four-letter suffix?
Right, so the FDA has issued draft guidance regarding the non-proprietary naming of biological products. So this isn't specific to biosimilar or interchangeable products. It actually covers all biological products with some exceptions that are noted in the draft guidance. And I will note that it's a draft guidance. The comment period has closed on that, so the agency is going through the comments and considering those comments as they move forward towards finalizing the guidance. But what's articulated in the draft guidance discusses the agency's policy recommendation that a four-letter random suffix be added to a core name, which in the U.S. would be the USAN, which typically does match the INN, but that would be a shared core name amongst biological products that had a related drug substance. And then there would be the unique four-letter suffix that would be added to it. The agency, once the policy is finalized, will need to develop a process policy around how that will work. Right now, we're doing it in terms of application-specific interactions with sponsors and asking them to submit their suggestions, and we do review them internally. We have a naming working group within CDER that is also has representatives from CBER as well, but there's a group of people all across CDER who are involved in this from areas in Gerald's office, in O&D, in our Office of Regulatory Policy, in our Office of Pharmaceutical Quality. So we have a number of representatives that are across that, including the Office of Medical Policy. And we do review those and would provide feedback within the specific context of an application to a sponsor for a particular product.
And how many do you need? How many do we submit?
Again, that's right now we would ask a sponsor to provide some recommendations to us, maybe two or three to begin with, but we do need to review them. It's the due diligence of the sponsor to ensure when they submit it that they make sure it's not infringing on any trademarks or other things. We do ask that sponsors do their due diligence in that space. Then we will look at it in terms of confusion, any risk for medication errors, and provide feedback. Depending on what the sponsor does submit, though, there may be a need if the initial suffixes are not acceptable for whatever reason, that there may need to be the submission of additional ones. So we certainly, I can't give a number as to what that would look like. It just depends on the course of that review.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Chirag Patel, Global Regulatory, Bristol Myers Squibb. My question is kind of a curveball. We know that China is going to become the second largest pharmaceutical market probably by 2020. And so I've been to a couple of sessions here at DIA about how China is trying to reform, as you well no doubt are aware of the regulatory reform that's happening in China. I was just curious as if the panel can comment on what kind of things the FDA is doing to help support the China reform and how they're collaborating, as this will be a very, very major market moving forward for patients in China and around the world.
Okay, I think that has implications for several of you. Okay. Mike, would you like to start?
One of the things that we've been doing is that we have an office and we have an individual that's there in China, part of the FDA acting as a liaison between the China regulatory authorities as well as the FDA. From a quality standpoint, that's all I can talk about. In terms of that, we've had groups that have gone there, take a look at their, the way they do their inspections, how they look at quality, and kind of their overall philosophy about quality in terms of their manufacturing, the quality of the submissions that they provide in terms of the CMC section. We are looking to have China at some point in time come to our White Oak site as well to sit with us and to continue those discussions. But we are trying to provide some kind of understanding in terms of what we do, want to look at what they do, and then just kind of exchange ideas and maybe even look at best practices.
So CFDA, the China FDA, has a pharmacovigilance meeting every 2 years where they bring in pharmacovigilance staff from their various provinces. Industry's present at that meeting, and they often invite someone from US FDA, EMA, WHO, Uppsala Monitoring Center, so to bring in some other perspectives there. And there's also the DIA China meeting as well.
I would add to that that with the reforms of ICH and the expansion of the potential membership of ICH from the initial just the tripartite regions, that ICH has certainly, as you know, we've been engaging with CFDA, inviting them to participate in the meetings, which they can do as observers, as can any other party until they apply for membership, because we consider them a very important stakeholder, a very important source of technical expertise that could contribute to those guidelines. And so we've been engaging with them to try to bring them into that very important harmonization process.
So I think this is something that is going to become more and more important over the next few years, and we will have to work together more. But DIA has been instrumental in having meetings to help industry and regulators talk to each other. And so I really appreciate the question. Start thinking about questions for Lynn. I haven't heard anything about pediatrics or maternal health.
Hello, yes. Deepa Deshpande. I'm a regulatory affairs consultant. And my question is related to the recently formed OPQ. How has OPQ, you know, the formation of OPQ impacted how you review combination products or fixed-dose combination, which involve cross-center review with CDRH and CBER? Is there any change in how you're doing it?
Yeah, in reference, you know, you bring up a good point, and that's been something that we've been working on, especially with CDRH for the combination products. When I say combination products, these are drug-device combination products, not multiple drug combination or fixed-dose combination products. So we are working with CDRH to better figure out the process to be able to do those assessments. We are going through a number of working groups that are in place to be able to find that more specifically, to expedite those reviews and to define roles and responsibilities across the two centers.
So is there a timeline for this in terms of when you might establish procedures, or is there any outcome to this, or is it just as a sponsor, is this going to be visible to us in any way?
Well, the working groups are working on that right now. There's a number of issues that we do need to address, so the timing on that has not been well defined. We still have to identify what the issues are and figure out how best to address those. And then once we do that, you know, timing will become, you know, we'll fall out of all that work. So, you know, as we get closer and closer to that, obviously we will begin to share that more openly.
So my question actually is simpler than the other one. So what is the role of OPQ, the current role of OPQ in review and approval of new BLAs and new NDAs?
We provide the review function, which would be the CMC function, for NDAs, ANDAs, as well as BLAs. But that, you know, once we do our part, that then goes back to the specific office. You know, if it's a new drug, it goes back to OND, generic goes back to OGD, and they take and put our piece in with the rest of the assessment for that application. But we are responsible for doing the quality assessment for those applications.
Okay, does your assessment also include the PAI inspection?
Yes, we do the pre-approval that comes out of our office for process and facility. We work in conjunction, though, with ORA, which is the Office of Regulatory Affairs. That's the inspectorate. So we work with them to actually then define the timing and the need to do those PAIs, pre-approval inspections.
Sandy, and I should emphasize, which they talked about it the first time, it's okay for you all to ask questions of each other. And this is sort of what's happening now.
Sandy Queter, Office of International Programs. I have a question for Dr. Yao. And that is the pregnancy label and lactation labeling rule has been in final form and being implemented for some time now. And I know there have been a lot of labelings under review. And I'd like to just hear you reflect a little bit on what it's been like at FDA to implement this new rule, and maybe say a little bit about some of the challenges and the experience of the staff in trying to get it right.
So most of you know that the final pregnancy lactation labeling rule was posted and published in December of 2014. It implemented at the end of June of last year. So we've got, hey, it's the anniversary. Today's the anniversary. So it's been 1 year in effect. And we've tried very hard to reach out to stakeholders, to reach out to sponsors, to make sure that this new labeling paradigm addresses the needs of prescribers and patients, which is to provide better information so that prescribers and patients have a conversation about how to use a drug during pregnancy and lactation. Now, one of the things that we've learned through the course of the year is that the format's very pretty. There's a risk summary in each section, and you can see where the animal data are and where the human data are. So we're happy about the structure. We've heard good feedback about the structure. The problem, really, as we've come to learn, is that it's not really helpful to have a format that's clear if you've got no data to incorporate into these sections. And so what I think it spurred us to begin to have a conversation, more detailed conversations about, or how do we get quality information to support the safe use of these products that are already approved. If a product gets approved for an adult population, it's approved for women, including potentially pregnant women. So the safety data go into the sections for pregnancy and lactation to support that. And oftentimes we just don't have good quality safety information to inform. So we are thinking about ways to improve the post-marketing collection of safety data. We've worked very closely with Gerald's group. We also have just convened a workshop in April to talk about how we can get quality lactation information. Because again, we know that nutrition in a baby is best accomplished through breastfeeding. And so there's a clear benefit to nursing a baby. And so how does taking a drug when a woman's lactating affect that risk-benefit equation? So we're very interested in engaging drug developers, patients, and prescribers in moving forward. And we hope that as you start to see the labeling change, you know, as with any new labeling program, you'll see kind of regulatory statements that look fairly consistent, morph over time. And that's as we learn information, how we hear that the information is best transmitted to prescribers. So we're trying not to be very pedantic and proscriptive about the information how you state the information as it appears in labeling.
Steve Caffey with Sukempo Pharmaceuticals. I have a question, I think, for Dr. Jenkins. A couple of days ago, there was an announcement from the White House and the commissioner about the creation of the OCE, the Oncology Center of Excellence. You know, the press releases said this is to accelerate oncology development programs, marshal resources across the FDA with oncology expertise, and so on. And so it sounded like the responsibility of the OHOP director, and who actually is moving into the job. So could you comment on why this, the creation of this role was necessary, and how is that going to work with OHOP and what might change?
Right. Well, I think the announcements noted that Dr. Pastor is moving to that role on an acting basis, not on a permanent basis, and that the stand-up of OCE is very much a work in progress. So it's still evolving to what exactly the functions of that Center of Excellence will be and how it will work across the various product review centers to help to coordinate the review of oncology products and help develop consistent policy and practices across the differing review centers. So it's very much a work in progress, and I don't know that I can give you much more specifics at this point other than, you know, Dr. Pasder has been tapped to be acting to help stand up that program, and we'll have to, you know, be aware over time of how it evolves.
This question is for Dr. Yao. There's been a lot of discussion about real-world data, and I also attended your session yesterday on extrapolation in peds. And I wanted to get your perspective on how data coming from, say, published literature, collaborative studies, studies that are not conducted by the sponsor, could fit in when you also have an extrapolation strategy that's valid, good data in adults, safety in PK in kids.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So, you know, I think that in the pediatric drug development space, there are ethical requirements, as we talked about yesterday, that, again, require us to not study children unless we're going to get information. And that's why the paradigm of pediatric extrapolation is so important, that we want to take all the information that we have, all that prior information and knowledge, and decide whether or not in the situation where we have an adult approval based on adequate and well-controlled data based on substantial evidence, how much less we could actually use to support approval in children. And so to your point about real world, we would accept any information that incorporates the use of the product in a different indication in children or adult information that would support pediatric out in the real world. So we believe that as extrapolation matures, that the practice of pediatric extrapolation matures, that we'll be able to provide more formal structure around how we would view different types of information, real world versus controlled data versus safety data, that will help us to construct what actually we need short of adequate and well-controlled trials to support pediatric approval. But I think real-world data is something that we want to look very hard at and how we could incorporate that into a pediatric extrapolation exercise.
And do you envision incorporating some of that data into future labeling?
Well, that's a good question. I think we haven't thought too much about how real-world information would be incorporated into pediatric labeling. Certainly, I think the question really is how much do we have, how much do we need, where are the gaps? We fill those with the information that we would collect, and then we would provide, I think, a synopsis or discussion, brief discussion of that potentially in labeling. But I don't think, I couldn't tell you more than how that would be incorporated into labeling at this point.
Laurie Myers from Merck. I work on health literacy. And my question is, we've heard a lot in the first two sessions today about patient-focused drug development. And of course, congratulations on exceeding the number of patient input sessions that were promised in PDUFA. When I think about all the other topics I've heard, whether it's carton and container labeling, whether it's the naming, it strikes me that there is also value in a patient perspective in some of these things that are not specific to a therapeutic area. And I'm wondering, A, how you're thinking about that, and also, B, are you also including respondents with low health literacy in any way? Because in my experience, their perspective can be quite different than advocates who are very well-versed in a disease and very comfortable stating their opinion. And anyway, I'll stop. Thank you.
I guess I'll start.
Thank you.
And so you're right about the patient-focused drug development. That has been focused on more upstream. Mm-hmm. But I think that we also talk in those sessions and, you know, if you seen the slides we use, we say, yes, start early to find out what matters to people, but that's not the only place where you might want to engage people, and that's not the only place that FDA does engage or plan to, certainly. So that's a very good observation, and I think we're trying to figure out the most effective way to engage, and maybe we don't need to go by therapeutic area, but maybe we do. Sometimes we have to look at those questions. We do are concerned that people understand that further downstream, people understand the labeling, which, you know, as we know, I mean, there's lots of opportunity for improvement.
Yes.
With that. And certainly low health literacy, our Office of Medical Policy, and I'm afraid we don't have a representative here, is very much concerned with and looking at that, and they have a pretty robust research program, and so my guess is that they have one. When I see them, I'll mention this question. We are also back up there in the drug development area. We are addressing and identifying the question in our internal discussions among the people in OND who do the clinical outcome assessment work and the people in statistics who do focus on the PRO and other kind of COAs, the making it accessible to people who have low literacy, low health literacy, English is not their first language, and there are a variety of people, and many practical reasons why we need to be addressing all that in those instruments as well. So,
thank you.
Good question.
Gerald?
Yeah, let me just add about the low literacy. This is quite important to us. We held an advisory committee about 6 or 7 weeks ago on the assessment of the REMS for the extended-release long-acting opioids. And as part of this assessment, the companies do knowledge testing of the key risk messages for those products. And when we presented the data, it was actually quite clear that the survey participants, a non-random sample, a convenience sample basically, had a level of education much higher than the average American, and we would assume that the users of these products have a range of education more similar to the country as a whole rather than to the sample. So that was pointed out as something that really does need more attention, is to capture people in these surveys with lower literacy levels and see how well they do.
So we've actually learned that generally people with low health literacy are not in the databases that pharma is using, and we've actually been spending some time to figure out how to do that. So we're happy to share that with you if that would be helpful as well.
In the space of biosimilars, we actually have an active education and outreach process. We have two contracts right now. Right now we focused on healthcare providers at this point, creating a CME course, as well as engaging a contractor for message development and testing. The next phase of that message development and testing will go towards patients and consumers, and we will again look at message development, testing that messaging, and then rolling out any updated messaging. We do have a consumer patient page for biosimilars, in addition to pages dedicated to industry and healthcare professionals. When we issue guidance documents, draft guidance documents, we are doing outreach and notification through CDER as well as FDA's patient-focused networks to make sure that those organizations are aware that those documents are out there, encourage them to submit comments. We do the same thing for the advisory committee meetings for the biosimilars. We have the open public hearing that occurs at all of those advisory committees. We have two advisory committee meetings that are coming up in mid-July. So again, we encourage the patient stakeholders to have a voice in those interactions as well. And we do have and have had and continue to have listening meetings with the patient organizations where we will sit down with them, hear their concerns. Again, that goes towards our messaging, but we're also taking those messages back into the drug development space for biosimilars.
And one other comment is with the REMS, it's potentially not just making it health literate, but I think there's also an overall comment we've heard from patients that in addition to risk information, they're interested in also understanding why they should take a product in the labeling, and I know we're a long way from that. But I wonder if the current processes get to that. So thank you very much.
That's a topic that has always been very close to me, and I'm delighted to hear it discussed. I have a question for all of you. Could each of you please comment on what are the three research gaps in regulatory science that need to be addressed in the next 5 years? Not a big question at all.
Well, I guess I'll start, and since the regulatory science, whoever came up with this question was generous enough to leave that open-ended, maybe we can, I'll pick an area. Let's say that regulatory science includes what's now being referred to as the science of patient input. And there are a number of research questions related to that, a number that have to do with the various kinds of performance outcome measures, the use of wearables, how can you use wearables as a data collection tool in clinical trials, other performance measures, understanding how to really create fit for purpose, develop fit for purpose patient reported outcome measures. How do we effectively measure treatment burden? This is when you hear about people in the patient, when we have these meetings, people tell us about how difficult it is to, if they have drugs that are they can take, the regimens they have to follow, and they usually are taking, of course, multiple drugs. Dealing with the side effects of the drugs that they're taking and the dosing regimens and even just working through the packaging can be quite complex. And so this is very obviously multidimensional. So how would you try to capture that in a way that's analyzable? I think I've come up with more than three so far.
That's okay.
So at any rate, there are many questions in this area that I think we want to try to come up with pretty good answers for so that we can move forward and have information that's fit for regulatory decision making and can be used and is affordable and easy enough for patients to respond to, and the information can be captured in trials so that it's available for decision making. So that's, I'll stop there.
John, would you like to address this one?
Well, I think one area that we get a lot of questions about is, how do you go from having something that's a biomarker to that being a surrogate endpoint? So in some ways that's a research gap, in some ways that's a evidentiary standard discussion about what level of evidence is needed to take something from being a biomarker, something you can measure in a patient, and considering that to be a surrogate endpoint that could either support accelerated approval or traditional approval. And I think that's a challenging area for a lot of people in the industry. There's a lot of interest in biomarkers. As we learn more about the science of the disease, the pathophysiology of the disease, we have greater ability to identify biomarkers. But then there's the question of when to use those biomarkers as the surrogate endpoint to support approval. We obviously get pressure on both ends on that question. So there's a lot of desire to use biomarkers as surrogates to accelerate approval and get products to patients sooner. We get criticism on the other side that you're using surrogate endpoints, so you don't really know if the drug is having value to the patient. So that's, I think, the research gap on whether the evidentiary standards to be comfortable in using something that used to be a biomarker as a surrogate so that you can feel confident that you're providing clinical benefit to the patient in the setting of a traditional approval, or that it's reasonably likely to predict clinical benefit in the setting of an accelerated approval. So I think that's one area I would highlight. I'm not going to do three because we each do three. We won't have time for other questions, but I think that's an important one that comes to mind.
Okay, yes, Gerald.
So I would say another area that we've certainly seen in the domain of REMS assessments and other things is really understanding the impact of what we do to convey conditions of safe use to patients. What's the impact of, for example, of changing a label on how a medicine is used? If you look at a lot of the published studies that look at the impact of an FDA warning, a lot of them simply measure how the number of dispensed prescriptions changed. And it's a very crude number. It went from, let's say, 700,000 to 600,000 or something like that. It doesn't tell you anything about the patients to whom it was dispensed. Are the people who shouldn't be getting the medicine now not getting the medicine? Or is it people maybe who should still be getting the medicine who are now not getting the medicine? We don't really have a good handle on that. And the further we move away from process elements and things that are easily countable, like number of prescriptions, toward actual medical outcomes, the harder it is to get data. And we really want to be at that end of the spectrum, what's really happening to patients. And we don't have the links between all these measures yet to get there. I think we've seen this in a number, for example, of REMS assessments.
Yes, Mike.
Yeah, Nance, if I could just mention also on the quality side, one of the areas where we really need to continue to do a lot of regulatory science work is on emerging technologies. One of the biggest things and one of the areas that I really am passionate about is moving along manufacturing science. We're looking at new technologies. There's new ways, more efficient ways to manufacture products. You've seen the first 3D tablets, have been approved, continuous manufacturing. We're taking a look at new container closure systems as well. But in order for us to be able to understand those manufacturing processes and to be able to take a look at the critical quality attributes associated with those processes, with new packaging, with new closure systems as well, we need to continue to do work in that area. And to that end, we've established the Emerging Technologies team. There's a guidance that's out there that now defines how we can work and interact with the industry to be able to learn and understand those two new technologies very early on, so that when submissions are made, we're in a better position to move them through rather quickly.
Yeah, actually, it's a nice segue in between quality and clinical and evidentiary standards. Certainly in my space, one of the areas that we're seeing a lot of emerging work that's happening in the research space is around looking at the clinical relevance of quality attributes and being able to predict clinical outcomes from quality attributes. Folks know that the bedrock of demonstrating biosimilarity is the analytical similarity data of comparing those products on an analytical level and looking at
the critical quality attributes, but understanding why those are critical quality attributes and understanding the range of differences that could lead to different clinical outcomes, either in safety, specifically immunogenicity, as well as in the efficacy space. So it's taking the knowledge that we have around identifying those critical quality attributes in the manufacturing space, understanding the products more and more, seeing the emerging technologies and the analytics about our ability to characterize the products, and then looking at comparative assessments of products and then predicting clinical outcomes from the analytical similarity data. And just since 2010, since the biosimilar program started in the US, we've seen a lot of advances in that area, and I hope that we continue to see advances in those areas of moving the technology forward.
I'll just add, I've already said a couple things about pregnancy and lactation, the need to improve quality information to support labeling. On the pediatric side though, I think that we've had a lot of experience now over the last 20 years with BPC and PRE. It's been very, very, I think, beneficial to the health of children. But we've learned that there are still some gaps related to BPC and PRE, and that relates to pediatric-specific diseases, including neonates, rare pediatric cancers. And I do think that we've got to figure out a way to get those therapies available to those populations.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Henrik Nielsen from Novo Nordisk, and I have a question to you in the area of fixed dose combinations, so drugs that contain two or more active ingredients. The agency issued proposed rulings, I think, late last year. Can you tell us about the plan for finalizing those rules and if you have plans to issue specific guidance documents in some of the more detailed area of the fixed combination drugs?
Can you remind us what proposed rule you're referring to? Because it's not ringing a bell off the top of my head.
Okay, it was an update of the ruling about the rules around when you combine two or more ingredients, it encompasses both the drugs and the OTC space. And you have guidance in the area of if there's are two or more being combined, non-approved drugs being combined, and especially around the non-clinical areas, that FDA already has guidance in place. But as there was a new proposed rule coming out, we were wondering when that was going to be finalized or if new specific guidances would be issued.
Well, we can never give you a specific date for when a final rule is going to be issued or a specific guidance, so I don't have any information I can share about that here.
I have a lot of good questions here, and we don't have that much time left, so let me ask a few of them. This is for Mike. The director of OPQ now has the OPQ creation, or how has it influenced PDUFA and GDUFA review performances? Has it improved the FDA review timeline performance, or has it brought improvements on some areas but a little setback in other areas?
I don't know, Teresa, if you want to kind of set the stage and then I could add my piece in.
I can just say on the PDUFA timeframes, it would be hard to improve them because they're so good. I mean, they exceed the 90% goal for review. And that's, of course, a very mature program. So one of the other things I'd add is that PDUFA was first authorized in 1992, and the program began in fiscal year 1993. So, you know, it's approaching its, 25th anniversary. And GDUFA has only began in 2013, fiscal year 2013. So you've got a new program being stood up in the case of GDUFA with many of the anticipated challenges of standing up a program, including hiring the people to do the work and so on, setting up a new process that's for the first time going to be meeting metric goals by the third year of the program. So 2015 would have been the first year that GDUFA goals kicked in to even reference. So, so that's a different place, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Now, the mature program, there's no issue, I think, with performance. I think it's very in a very good place. You heard earlier in the session before this about the challenges of trying to get to the facilities that are all around the world, but we're doing a reasonable job. We're working on strategies to make that even more of an easier job to do which we're already doing. And so I guess maybe Mike might be able to say more about, I think what's a very innovative approach that we've been taking since OPQ has been stood up with the integrated or team-based approach and bringing product experts along on the reviews for or PAI inspections and so on.
Right, yeah, no, I appreciate that, Teresa. I appreciate the way you set that up. Yeah, on the PDUFA side, that's, you know, as Teresa had pointed out, that's a mature program. So, you know, we've been humming along, and that's been, you know, in terms of meeting the goals there, we've been doing that very, very well. On the GDUFA side, since it is a new program, and we are putting in place, or we already have in place, a number of processes to help expedite those reviews, because I think as maybe many of you are well aware, our timelines are going to start getting tighter in terms of the review cycle come October of this year. So we go from a 15-month review down to a 10-month review. But we've put in place what we call IQA, and this was talked about yesterday at one of the sessions with myself as well as my deputy director, Dr. Lawrence Yu, about the integrated quality assessment. And as that name implies, it's integrated because it brings together all the subject matter experts across the appropriate groups, both within and outside of OPQ, so that assessment is done with the right people all together, working at the same time, you know, roughly, to be able to get that done very quickly. The other piece that we're doing is that we also want to have simultaneously the pre-approval inspection going on so that we could work with the field investigator to be able then to collaborate with the review person or people to be able then to answer questions and get those done collaboratively and very quickly in a very timely fashion. So we're trying to set those all up, and we've been reasonably successful in terms of the timing around those to make sure that the inspection as well as the review happen at the same time.
I have a question for Lynn. Part of PLLR includes information about risks due to the disease being treated. Is your group or the review divisions working to standardize information about background risk for products that treat the same disease?
So that's a good question. It kind of hits two parts. Under the new labeling rule, there is a place where we can add clinical considerations. So for example, if the disease itself causes potential risk to a pregnancy or to the baby, the example of type 2 diabetes, we can put information about the risk of the disease itself on the pregnancy or on a woman who's lactating. But separate from that, there is a requirement in the rule that says that we need to establish and provide information about background rates of major congenital malformations and miscarriage in all labeling. And so people have read that to say, well, you must have some sort of standard statement that you have to use. And the fact is that you don't have to use a standard statement. But the intent of that statement was really just to provide prescribers with a basis for the conversation. You know, all pregnancies carry risk, even in a healthy woman who's not taking any drugs. You know, there's a risk of major congenital malformations of 2 to 4%, depending on what you read. And there's a risk of miscarriage of up to 15 to 20%. So the idea of putting that information there was just to simply ground prescribers when they're having a conversation with their patients about drugs used during pregnancy. It's not really intended to be used as a comparison. And so we want to have that information appear. We want it to not be misleading. We want it to be helpful. So, of course, any comments or suggestions you have, we've used a standard statement, but we have told the review divisions in CDER and CBER that that statement can be modified to make sure you send the right message.
We have about 5 minutes left, and so I'd like to start at the far end with Mike and ask each of our panelists to give us 30 seconds about what they wish they had been asked to talk about today. That maybe wasn't emphasized as much as it could have been.
For me, being new to the FDA and being new to the public sector, I thought I would have gotten a question around, you know, Mike, how was the transition going from the private sector into the public sector? What are some of the challenges? Either that, or I have a strong passion for doing dog agility and dog obedience training, and how have I used that to actually manage my groups? But,
sounds appropriate.
So, I'll leave it at that.
Lynn?
I can't say I wished I was asked about this, but certainly I'm surprised that no one asked about interchangeability in terms of the agency's activities around that. You know, certainly it's on our guidance agenda for this year, and we continue to push towards issuing guidance on interchangeability. We know it's a key guidance that industry is looking for and other stakeholders are looking for. So, you know, it's a top priority for us, and I really hope it will get out this year as expected from the guidance agenda.
It's hard to list what things people could have asked that weren't asked. I think one of Dr. Kahlo's major initiatives, and one's very critical to the agency that no one raised, is recruitment, retention of the qualified staff that we need to do our important work. It's an ongoing challenge, and I was surprised no one brought that up, because Dr. Kahlo has made that one of his signature initiatives while he's been at FDA.
It was alluded to in one of the questions I didn't get to, but thank you for doing. Lynn?
I guess I wished I would have been asked about how we can work together, and I mean in a true sense together, to get information that we need to support the safe use of drugs for women and children and infants. I think that we are really working hard on trying to improve our global collaborations, global product development, and reaching out to stakeholders, patients, drug developers, academics. And so I would have liked to have heard a question about that.
Gerald?
I thought I would have been asked a question about more details about how we're integrating Sentinel into the review process. We've transferred, as I mentioned, the responsibility of the program to my office. We've had extensive training, not only for our staff, but the staff of Office of New Drugs, Office of Biostatistics, and we've really ramped up our use of that program and have integrated it more fully into the review process.
My question would be sort of along the lines of John's, which someone might have asked, well, with all this new science and the analytic sciences that you would need for really going at it with real-world evidence or this patient-focused stuff or biomarkers and so on, does FDA have the staffing to do this work? And frankly, are we as an ecosystem training enough people to be qualified to do this work well? Because we've encountered tremendous shortages in certain of these scientific areas, analytic sciences, and even if we could get our federal hiring systems worked out, which we're working on, are there enough people being trained to support all the work that companies are doing, that academic research centers are doing, that FDA needs to have to be able to sustain progress? So it's a hiring question, too.
Well, I would like all of you to join me in thanking our panel for being so open to all of your questions. And I would like to thank all of you for sticking around till the bitter end. This is the last session. I hope you have had a wonderful DIA meeting. I hope to see you at future meetings. And thank you for staying through our session.